Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Midrats. We are here live, and if you're live, if you wanted to roll into the chat room at the bottom of the show page, we've already got our favorite cow there across the quarterdeck. I don't know where the Withingtons are today, but if you'd like to, go ahead and roll in there, because today, as the advertisement says, this is our ever-popular melee format. We're open topic, open mind, even open phones. If you have some topics that piqued your interest this week you would like for us to address, you can put it right there in the chat room. We'll be glad to pull that in as we go over the next hour. Or if you just want to give us some feedback and tell us how we are, how incorrect we are, that's a good place to do it as well. And when we have our free-for-alls and our melees, we always like to tell our regulars that make the effort to join us live. But if you'd like to call the studio, our studio number is area code 347-308-8397. We'd love for you to call in, tell us what's making you ponder. But it's not just me. I have, of course, my ever-genial co-host, Eagle One, join us with us this afternoon. How are things up there?
Everything's good up here. It's a little warmer than I like it to be, but that will change in a month or two. So
we're good. Yeah, you get better weather about a month and a half before we do. I like to say that humidity is Mother Nature giving you her warm embrace. I try to struggle through that as much as possible. But, I made the mistake of doing physical labor till about 2 this afternoon, and that was a bad idea. But that's okay. The one great thing about having an afternoon show is during the hot months it gives me an excuse to come inside and get cleaned up and relaxed.
Yeah, exactly. We challenged fate again, went for a 5-mile hike, and it was quite warm out there. I don't mind so much if there's a breeze, but when the breeze dies, ugh.
Yeah. They one advantage of being relatively close to the coast is we do have a little breeze, but the hottest I'd ever been in my life is, I remember as a little kid, used to go visit my grandparents and relatives in Mississippi. And that wasn't Gulfport, Mississippi. That was well inland Mississippi. The house my mother grew up in was built in 1840. Didn't have air conditioning. And so you dealt with summers with lots of fans. And when my grandmother moved into the other house after my grandfather passed away, she had one window air conditioner in the living room. And besides that, one thing the kiddies don't appreciate nowadays is back in the South, used to have these, they're not ceiling fans, they're attic fans, which I think were surplus P-40 engines from World War II. You crank that puppy up. You had to have door stops in there, or doors would slam all over the place. Cats, small children go flying through the air. But, yeah, you just had, if you didn't have air circulating, you're in a little bit of trouble. So I can't complain. My ancestors dealt with it. Okay.
Yeah, it's So what do you want to talk about today? We've put out a challenge there to see what we're going to discuss. And you had some suggestions.
Yeah, I liked your idea, though. I think, and I think a lot of the guests would find it interesting as well, especially those of a certain age who remember the 1990s military. You know, TQL, which was the Navy's spot welding of total quality management. And as a byproduct of that, inside the Navy, dimming got a little bit of a bad press. And I think it was really unfortunate, because a lot of his ideas should be looked at in the Navy, especially, and this is line I've been using since the 1990s. In maintenance and in support and some of the business functions with a small B that the Navy is involved in, Deming's concepts are very, very, very good. And you, offline, I just go ahead and bring up some of your bold-faced items of your defense of Deming, because I think you made some really good points.
Yeah, let me go from where I started. I was reading an excellent piece in a National Review by our friend Jerry Hendricks about how the, you know, he took the Cotton Report, which has Congress people looked at the Navy and said, what in the world is going on here? And he took that and he pointed out that there were some great truths in that document. But he also put in there, this is kind of where my mind goes. He put in there that the part of the problem was the push for efficiency, which he laid at the feet of Deming. And I am somewhat of a Deming acolyte in the sense that once I read more than just what the Navy was trying to push, because total quality leadership was a stupid idea. I agree with that. But if you follow the basics of Deming, what he was trying to say is, look, we're about trying to make sure, if you want to be a successful business or a successful Navy, you want to make sure that you have properly trained people with the right tools to do their jobs, and that we want to continually improve. And he had other things he focused on, but one of them was what he called constancy of purpose. And constancy of purpose is you have to know what you're trying to do in order to be successful. So if you're Toyota, your goal is to produce cars, and you want to produce quality cars, and you want to make sure that in order to do that, you have to the backside of that is properly trained people who have the right tools to do their jobs and who continually find new ways to make the process of making those cars better. That's pretty simple. Now, in the Navy, since I remember Deming coming out, the question was, what is our purpose? And my feeling is, and I think that what Jerry kind of missed on here, and I think he got to it in the article. I really recommend reading that article. I put a link to it up on the chat room. But the constancy of purpose is what is missing in the Navy. And there's a lot of discussion in both the Cotton Report and Jerry's piece in National Review about how administrative functions took precedence over war fighting. Well, I mean, that's not constancy of purpose. If you're going to be an administrative agency, maybe that's exactly what you want to end up with. But we lost the strategic vision of why we have a Navy. And part of that reason that we have a Navy is to fight wars. And when you look at the Cotton Report, that's one of the things they say. We should prioritize war fighting. We should encourage risk taking. We should up our training. We should do operational stuff. We should get the politics and media out of the wardrooms. True. All of that is true. And in the business context, somebody once wrote, the first problem is dealing with everyday issues, including quality, production, sales, and profits. The second problem is dealing with and planning for the future. Most companies have people, systems, plans, and resources in place to deal with daily issues. And if you're going to be an administrative agency, maybe we've got those in place. However, the companies that don't plan and address the future can lead to serious trouble. So if we look at what we're doing with everyday issues, we've got some issues there. We don't, as Jerry and other people have pointed out, material readiness, adequate training, especially for SWOs, are deficient. And Jerry put it, in the end, the vast preponderance of the respondents, this is to a survey that was done by these Congress people, that something was wrong with their Navy, and the reasons behind this dangerous change fell along several broad categories. First and foremost, they believe the Navy had placed insufficient focus on warfighting, even it has increased administrative burdens throughout the Navy over the past 30 years. Second, the report highlights the trend toward finding efficiencies within the surface warfare community. This, in turn, contributed to the report report's next finding, decline in investments in training across the surface force in particular, as well as an overall decline in attention to ship maintenance, both in terms of schedule discipline and overall investment. The report also raises the specter of micromanagement of individual Navy ships, an issue that is at odds with the Navy's long historical tradition of independence of command, which eroded the confidence of individual ship commanding officers and sapped their individual freedom of action. Lastly, the report cites concerns with the Navy's rising oversensitivity to media reporting of Navy incidents. These complaints, in my view, demonstrate a fundamental failure in SWOLAND to deal with everyday issues because the bubble has been lost on the larger issues, which ought to drive the processes of the daily issues. It's as if we lost our way and failed to remember the why of Navy's existence and began to focus on things like paperwork and social issues. And I used to see this in big companies that I work with. When the founding members of the company left and they got brought in professional management, then the focus of the company shifted from long-term planning to try and chase things that would affect the future of the company to trying to deal with current stock prices, because that's where professional management was making their money. It was, you know, if they got stock options and stuff, they really wanted to boost local revenue, and they had to deal with, I mean, short-term revenue. They weren't really looking necessarily down the road at what is this company going to look like 10 years from now, 15 years from now, or even 5 years from now. So they stopped trying to be the best company in the market niche, and it really did hurt them. So Jerry and Brian McGrath, they know the purpose of the Navy. Many of their thoughts are great. I think Deming was misconstrued when we looked at him in the past. It might be useful to look at him again. We try and sort out the mess that our current CNO inherited. And that's pretty much my diatribe for the minute.
Some of the items that did just leapt out to me, and you know, I'm not going to go into my critique of TQL because I'll get an eye twitch, but it was a misunderstanding and misapplication. But the things that just absolutely are spot on, and I'll tie in this part later on, the right tools for the job, the right training, continuous improvement, those everyday issues. It's kind of a subset of what we talk about here on a not infrequent basis is the unsexy but important. It's those everyday issues, though, that can be very, very hard, whether we're talking about proper shipyard procedures, maintenance procedures, or I have an admin shop of a YNC, a YN1, a YN2, and two YNSNs, but I need three more yeomen to do the amount of admin paperwork they're asking me to do. What do I do? Okay, everybody's going to work 100 hours a day, and you're not going to get the qualifications you need. How do you address that? It's hard. It's a lot easier to weigh in on those softer social issues, and you know, it's the left-handed Volvo drivers month. So I'm going to make a video with my wife and kids at a Volvo dealership talking about how wonderful Swedish engineering is, as opposed to looking at, you know, how do I get more work out of the shipyards and more money to fund it. And this push for efficiencies that we really saw, it always been with us, and it started in the 90s and trying to work through the quote peace dividend unquote. But it reminded me of the U.S. auto manufacturers in the 1970s. They got hit with a shock, and they had a variety of courses of action they could take, and they had the wrong leadership that doubled down year after year going in the wrong direction, whereas the quality and the desirability of Japanese and, to a lesser extent, depending upon the brand, European cars in the 70s increased. The U.S. car makers just could not do it because they were so set on efficiencies, whether it was the only difference between a 1977 Oldsmobile and a 1977 Pontiac was the front grille and the lights, and that was about it. And, yeah, as a young man who got his first car in the mid-80s, you know, there's a reason why a lot of us drove cars from 1962 to 1973. They had character, they had panache, they had fun, they still rode pretty well. And we generally made fun of people who got cars in the 1970s because the cars were a manifestation of bad decisions and related to trying to make profits during the 1970s. It does go back to the leaders and the decisions they make. And, you know, when you're talking about the companies, you brought up, you know, instead of long-term planning, they're chasing the current stock price. And I think at a first glance, people go, well, the Navy is not a company, is not concerned with P&Ls and balance sheets, though in a way it is. What is the Navy equivalent of that? Well, what we've seen over and over, the current stock price, a lot of that is driven by the compensation plans for senior executives, where based upon quarterly or fiscal year performance or a combination of the two, they will be giving bonuses, and whether cash, usually stock options. And so their goal is to maximize their quarterly results. Who gives a damn what happens in 36 months? Because this company rarely keeps a CEO past 24 months. So I'm going to get what I can. Yes. What is the Navy equivalent of that? The Navy equivalent of that is, what's my next job at the end of my PCS cycle? When is the next selection board? Or if I'm retirement eligible and decided to take the off-ramp, what are my motivations to upset Company X and Company Y? Because there are no restrictions as me as an outgoing 3 or 4 star of getting employment with that exact company. I would really like to be on the board of Raytheon. I don't think I'm going to do something to torque them off because I've been talking to their guys for the last 3 years on this project we've been working with for the last 18. I'm not going to be able to fix it anyway. Why rock the boat? You do that through 4 or 5 different PCS cycles, and you find a lot of the issues that we have. I'm not saying these people are corrupt. I'm not saying these people are bad. I am saying these people are human. And humans and human institutions respond to positive stimulus and negative stimulus. And I think that focus on the current stock price, how that manifests itself in the boardrooms of various corporations that, you know, Sears is another example. Walmart expanded while Sears, who had every advantage in the world, just imploded upon themselves because of their front office mistakes. We need to look at that. What are the motivations of our senior leadership that will push them towards having a longer-term focus and more of a stewardship focus as opposed to the palm cycle focused that a lot, not all, but a lot seem to do. And I think it's been manifested. I think you outlined the last 30 years, which I think is a pretty good time frame to put it in.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these things are not surprises. We had the Belisle report, you know, that was 2010. And, you know, the Navy wasn't funding, planning or conducting surface ship maintenance the way it should have back then. I mean, so 11 years ago, we had this problem. And, you know, that raises the issue of who is actually in charge of this stuff. I mean, what happens is the aviation community did a great job of saying, look, we have to go through this expensive and intensive training cycle for our pilots, or we're going to have and our maintenance crews, because otherwise airplanes are going to fall out of the sky, and we can't have that because that's really bad. The nuke power guys, submariners, and our surface nukes, like the aircraft carriers, you know, they also go through these extensive training programs, and safety is the key issue. So who was speaking for the surface Navy? The surface Navy was speaking for itself, and their attitude was can do, will do, you know, because we're taking all these cuts. We've promoted ducks to positions that other ducks liked. And, you know, I think you end up with this people not saying, every now and then you get somebody who does it, you know, I can't do that. We can't do that anymore because it's unsafe. I don't have the trained crew. I don't have the right tool for the job. This ship needs to be put into the yards. Now, if every, and you know, you can always, been a SWO, you can always go to sea with X component. Now, okay, my 5-inch gun mounts are down, but I'm only going to go do ASW training, so who cares about the 5-inch gun mount at this point? You know, we have enough capability on most of our surface ships. You can get, you know, I can always go out to sea. If my turbines are working and my screws are working, I can go out and be a presence. It doesn't matter sometimes if your gear is right, and that's one of the things we saw in those collisions, was that not only was the gear being not necessarily working, but they're swapping people in who weren't familiar with the gear they had. You know, how dangerous does it have to be before somebody goes, wait a minute, I'll stop, let's straighten this out? And we've had those collisions, and I'm still not clear on what great improvements have been made since that time to train and to make sure our ships, the current ships, the ones we have out there at sea, are all up to speed. I mean, because it's a vastly expensive project to do that. The second thing is that I wonder about is, and I'm a SWO who grew up in the days when they put young officers on board ship to learn how to be OODs. We didn't have much in the way of a formal SWO training program and until PQS came out and all that. So many of us who grew up at that time became SWOs by having people like the CO of the ship ask us questions when we were on watch, like how far, given the height of eye on the bridge, how far can you see? You know, what are you going to do in this situation if you have this ship over here? And, you know, how are we going to con alongside? I mean, we would walk through that stuff while you're on watch. And if you didn't know the answer, you got to give that proper reply. I'll go find out, sir. So, you know, you talk to the other officers, you talk to CO, the senior watch officer, so you got trained. Now, SWAS sound like a great idea. And, I guess it's coming back, and I'm sure we have more simulators and all that stuff. But, you know, the deck plate, being out there on boats, I emphasize getting the junior officers in a position like the Coast Guard does. But you put them to sea, let them get their feet wet, put them in charge of something. I don't care if it's a 40-foot rowboat. They need to learn how to command something and get that experience, which will help them in the long run. And I just hope that we're seeing some of that. But we haven't learned the lessons of things we already knew, like the Belial report put out those number of years ago.
Yeah, I think it's great, but I set my teeth a little bit when I still see them coming up. I mean, it was over a decade ago, and people going, well, you know, the Belial report is like, yeah, a decade ago. We could have fought 2.5 World War IIs, and we're still talking about that. And you know, it speaks to a larger issue, but we've talked about fundamentals, and part of what you were describing about, you know, mentorship and coming up, it has to be, you know, supervision. It worked great. We were trying to find efficiencies, and with those efficiencies, you come cost cutting, and with the Belial report as well, you know, let's talk about the inefficiencies of time. And sometimes I ping on my friends in the legal profession, because everything, justice delayed is justice denied for both the accused and the victims, for both injured and accused, et cetera, and so forth. But back on the 23rd, Justin Katz put out an article on the Bahamas Shard. And it's been a year since that fire, and the report, you know, the ship burned for 4 days. It's going to be scrapped. We talked about it briefly on our last free-for-all. The investigation is still going on, but the amazing thing is Vice Admiral Roy Kitchener, he's the commander of Naval Forces, he said that, quote, in the context of industrial shipyard environment, the admiral said that a little more education and spot checking is needed. How many centuries has in the American and our mother country Royal Navy experience been in shipyards and have known the dangers of shipyards? Back when we had wooden ships full of hemp rope, gets nice and dry, to now we have, you know, petroleums, oils, lubricants all over the place. We're very good at fighting at sea, which is one thing that Vice Admiral Kitchener said. But They haven't released the results of the inspections. It's not done yet, which I think is just horrible in a variety of ways. I don't even know whether somebody's going to be charged. But they have put out that, and they're giving some hints about what they've discovered, because recently they put out additional guidance on the waterfront for private contractors and ship crew to do additional inspections. And Vice Admiral Kirscher said that we've made significant investments into fire detection systems since then. That tells me that the interesting part of the report is going to be, if they give us these details, what was the fire watch routine? What systems did they have in place? I would really like to know what, quote, efficiencies, unquote, they were trying to gain, as opposed to having, you know, human beings, as imperfect as we are, and especially from my dog's perspective, our noses are highly inadequate. But we got pretty good noses. We got pretty good eyes. We got pretty good ears. And if you've been at sea long enough, if you're just standing there, you can feel things. That's what I'm kind of getting hints at, is did we just have another example of people assuming risk, looking for efficiencies, ignoring the fundamentals, and lo and behold, the gods of the maritime copybook headings have come down to roost. If I can make
that
metaphor.
It's a good question. I don't know what the manning level of the Bonhomme Richard was while she was in the yards. I don't know whether they had a bunch of stuff. I mean, I think Sal Mercogliano suggested they, or maybe it was Byron, that they had a bunch of stuff down in the hole that, you know, was flammable. But, you know, one of the lessons we learned, sadly enough, as some of the sabotage was done to ships during the Vietnam War and slightly thereafter, where people would put salt in the boiler feed water and things like that, was to lock some of this stuff up so that if it was an area that didn't need, nobody was working in, you would lock the door. But, you know, I don't know. And more concerning to me is, if a fire was intentionally set and they know who did it, that's great. If it was an accident, then that's another thing. I know that on the inactive ship maintenance facilities that there used to be fire alarms and flooding sensors put on those ships, and that was 100 years ago. So, we should have had. If you're not going to man the thing, so you have enough people to walk around and do those fire watch checks, routine fire watch checks, then you really do need to invest in non-human assets to monitor various aspects of the ship.
You know, when we talk about efficiencies and cost savings, I should know, but I'm embarrassed that I don't. You know, what's the dollar value on the Bonhomme Richard? And she had just gotten back from a modernization overhaul to make her deck suitable for the F-35 Bravo. I want to say it's in the neighborhood of $3 billion. I guess I could do a Wikipedia lookup here. But, just go ahead and amortize that over the lifetime of the ship and how many shipyards, saving a penny to lose a dollar later. I guess that it goes back to what we started talking about, dimming, is that short-term versus a long-term focus. And I really should dust off my dimming. I'm embarrassed to say I actually have some of this stuff, which I'm not embarrassed to say. What he talks about risk. And I'm sure it's probably in the areas where he goes into the depth of quality, because that's part of building a quality of product and having good inspections, is it minimizes risk. But that would be an interesting thing to look at.
Yeah, oddly enough, that just got me thinking. Well, there are a lot of places. I mean, ships are, they're so complicated because of the number of spaces you have. But I can't imagine. I mean, how many fire smoke detectors do you have in your house? Do you have one on each floor, one in the kitchen and one in the laundry? I mean, how many and maybe I'm just out of date, but how many sensors are available now on Navy vessels that are monitoring? I know that probably on the LCSs they got a bunch of stuff like that because of the shortage of manning, but how about on the other ships? How are we monitoring? Do we have automatic monitoring systems to notify us if the space whatever is suddenly got smoke in it? That would be good to know. I don't know, back when I was on ships, we didn't have that kind of technology, but I'm sure we do now. Like on an airplane, I think you kind of know when your engines are on fire. So,
yeah. By the way, Sal Marcogliano, he did my brain work for me. We Sals have to stand together or sit together if we're drinking. It was $3.2 billion for the Bohan Richard, which is not a small change. And you brought up aviation and the aviation culture. That is one thing, and we talked about it right after the events of 2017. And it's fun to go back to because one of the great things about aviation is you can have heck, depending upon your community, it can be a Lieutenant JG. It can be an ensign he's on the schedule to go do a mission, and he'll walk in there and go, I'm not going. This plane's not safe. I've looked it over. Nope, this is not fixed. This is not right. I'm not taking it. Might get fussed at, might get grumped at. XO or the CO, 9 times out of 10, though, will back him up. There's not that culture in other places. You don't have to get to that extreme where, sorry, I'm not getting underway. We haven't seen that in a while, at least not breaking out into the open. We have seen some delayed departures that I think there was that conversation going on. It just never made it into open source. But that is a good culture to have, going back to 2017 when you had a ship goes up and tells its IFIC, I'm short X number of watch standers. And they go, okay, well, here's your X number of watch standers. They're not qualified for my ship. They haven't been trained on my system. Well, you want bridge keepers? They come from a cruiser. They're quality. You need to get underway. It's not the culture where somebody can say no to that. There have been some discussions since 2017 about changing that attitude. Hopefully that has gotten some root. But, that culture discussion I think it's all wrapped up in our incentive structures. Another thing that came out last week on the 21st, it was nice to see, but I laughed a little bit because I think it speaks a lot to another aspect of our culture. And I think it's fair to say the record of our show, you and I have been pretty nice about the USS Ford and its problems. We had, his name is slipping my mind right now, Tal Manville on to talk about it years ago. And he's the one who gave a real nice story about the original sin of Ford back to the Rumsfeld era. But, here we are in 2021, and just for the listeners, and I'll put this in the chat room here in a second, back on the 21 July interview with the CNO, I'm sorry to laugh, the Chief of Naval Operations, Mike Gilday, this is last Tuesday, said, quote, a more deliberate approach with respect to introducing new technologies into any platform, he said that over at the annual Sea Air Space Exposition. We really shouldn't introduce more than maybe one or two new technologies on any complex platform like that in order to make sure we keep risk at a manageable level, unquote. Here's my frustration. Why does it take until 2021 for a four-star admiral to say something like that when this has been a known problem for 15 plus years?
Yeah, great question. I assume that there's some unwritten code where you don't criticize your predecessors in office like the CNO. But, I think if I had the mess that he's got, I would probably say, well, I don't know how we got here necessarily, but, you know, we've got to straighten this mess out, so let's roll up our sleeves and get busy. The Ford, the LCSs, the, you know, the unproven technology that was going to go into the Zumwalt class ships, you just shake your head. I mean, thank God somebody saw the light and said, okay, we have this proven program that the Europeans have been they just followed up Plan Salamander, I guess, and said, this FREM thing looks like a good idea. We could really use something that didn't have all this super fantastic pipe dream unicorn breath to be right. thinking behind it, you know. I mean, I'm hoping that that's a really successful program, and no one listens to anybody who comes up, meets the bright idea fairy, and comes up, you know, we'll be a really great ship if we just added this humpty thing we haven't created yet.
Well, I was being Mr. Grumpy Puss towards the CNO for most of the month because of his diving into political and cultural issues that he doesn't blankety-blank belong, nor does our Navy. Anyway, but when I read that for like the third time before the show, the one thing that came into my mind is the reasons it's taken this long to talk about it at that level. I mean, we've had quite a few retired O5s and O6s on here who have talked about this for years. It's just getting it at the proper level that it needs to be out and open. It's fine and great. Is he can use this as a marker and as a signal for those that are working on the yet to be really fleshed out large service combatant that is the mulligan for the failure of CGX that was exactly that lack of program control, the ignoring of systems program and technology risk, budget risk, that if the CNO is following up on that statement with additional related statements, direction and guidance, and fan room counseling on those that are doing the large service command, because we can't afford to screw this up again. We cannot afford to screw this up. And we need to be cutting steel sooner more than later. And as you and I have talked about before, if I was emperor for a day, we would have already be building a cruiser, and we would have used the highly successful 1920s and 1930s cruiser development. It's like, hey, we're gonna do a run of a half dozen of this class, and while we're cutting steel on this one, we're going to have an improved another class of cruisers following up here that might induce some other technology. We may do a dozen of those, and then we're going to build off of that. And we made huge, huge improvements over the course of the 12 years. So our Navy was ready for 1941 when it showed up. And it wasn't just cruisers. A lot of the things that they developed for the cruisers, they used for the destroyers and the aircraft carriers, et cetera, and so forth. But if we just have this one-shot wonder of a large service combatant and the CNO has gone public with his religion about technology risk, that's great. That's sign of a learning institution that hopefully, and I don't know how far down the line we are on this, but maybe on the margins or in a significant point, that can help shape the development of the large service combatant and maybe even the final tweaks. Because I know we got to put the American stink on the FREM, and hopefully those engineering issues won't be issues. What will hopefully be a recurring theme from the CNO, that can help get those programs where they need to be this decade.
Yeah, I really commend everybody to read this Cotton report. I think there's a link on it still in the chat room. So. You know, it highlights the cascading disaster that happens when you extend ship maintenance, which the number of effects of that, which includes screwing up shipyard schedules, which includes, fostering this can-do attitude among our skippers of these ships, and the bifurcation between the people in the Navy who ought to be in charge of our ships and what they're doing, and the combatant commanders who just, well, I want a ship and I want it now. I really need it. You know, who's in control of the ship's schedules, and who's going to say no and tell the combatant commander, no, you can't have carrier X right now because, hey, we're basically running them into the ground. So figure out something else to do. You know, call on the Air Force. They always say they can do everything, so have them prove it. And Lord knows the Army, which is trying to make fun of the Navy, is always saying they can do everything. I just wonder how they're going to get there. But, you know, that's the lesson there, is that everything you push off, every decision you make that you know, we're going to keep going with what we have. Well, we keep going, but then you find out, well, if we do that, then there's a cost down the road, which is going to really impact us, especially in times of we don't have as many shipyards we used to have. We used to have Navy shipyards. We don't have very many of those anymore. You know, it just goes on and on. And we made decisions to reduce the size of the fleet. We were going to handle it with greater technology and stuff. Well, you know, there's a limit on the number of places you can be with a limited number of ships. And if you're going to provide X number of escorts for a carrier, that limits the number of ships you got available to do other things. And there's a really good story in the Cotton Report about the inefficient funding and unwillingness to commit to maintenance budgets. So they talk about a cruiser that they knew had, that people on the cruiser knew that the fuel tank tops in one of the machinery spaces needed to be replaced, but they didn't have the money to do it, so they didn't do it, and then eventually they went into the yard, and it cost them more because it was discovered that it had to be fixed. You could see daylight from the top of these tanks, and we just saw, you know, when they talked about, and Admiral Gilday talked about, there was a cruiser that had to come back into port. I think it was Admiral Gilday was talking about this because the fuel tank tops, the very same thing that's in the Scott report, were leaking. So, you know, you've identified a problem, you haven't solved the problem, and you're pretending it doesn't exist, it's going to go away by itself. I mean, it reminds me of a little kid with a toothache or something, you know. They'll just ignore it, and, we'll see what happens. But it just boggles the mind how we push off some of this stuff. And, you know, we're paying the price. And there's a big discussion in the chat room about the number of auxiliary force. You know, back in the days when I was on the ammo ship I was on, it was a USN ship. We had gun mounts. We had sailors doing all the work. Navy was bigger. We had more sailors. They're expensive. If we can pawn that off on the military sealift command, we don't have as many sailors, and it's probably cheaper, even at the high rate of pay of the MSC people, that it's probably cheaper to run them than it is to run a ship with 250 sailors on it. I mean, those are decisions that a bean counter makes, and you worry about that. The other side of things is that when we end our wars, everybody thinks there's going to be this great, when we ended Vietnam, there's going to be this great funding bloom. We'd have all the money we didn't spend, we were spending on the war, we could now use it for other things. Well, you know, that got taken away by Congress. And we, same thing after the Cold War. Well, we don't have the Russians, we don't need as big a Navy, we don't need la la la, and that got taken away. Well, where was the, you know, now we need that money. Where is it going to come from?
Yeah, it's funny how everybody thinks that war is going to go away. It's always such a short window, and geography and people, they really don't change. An interesting reminder of this, like the world can't catch a break, but it never has a break, is the one thing that I had history tap me on the shoulder, which was interesting, as the Chinese say it, to watch over the course of July. It's a tragic comedy in three acts. Is for those that have been tracking the latest, it would be funny if it wasn't so incredibly dangerous, but that whole wolf warrior attitude the Chinese have gotten in the last, you know, half decade or so, is back on July. I want to do a little quoting here, just so people don't think that I am an agent of the Chinese government. If you don't read Global Times, you really should. It can be humorous or scary depending upon your mood for the day. But right after July 4th and July 6th, the Deputy Prime Minister Taro Aso, who evidently has a history of saying things, the issue with Taiwan keeps coming up, and there's a colonial history with Japan and Taiwan. There's a World War II history. After World War II, culturally, there's a lot of connections between Taiwan and Japan, and that relationship has matured nicely. Anyway, going the direction that Japan should in the 21st century, they mentioned that should a Chinese invasion of Taiwan, that would present Japan with an existential threat. And if that invasion should occur, that Japan and the United States must intervene together. And he said, and this is a quote from the Deputy Prime Minister, quote, if a major incident happened over Taiwan, it's safe to say it would be related to the situation threatening the survival of Japan. If that is the case, Japan and the U.S. must defend Taiwan together. Well, that got a nice little response from one of the usual suspects in Global Times, a Song Zhongping, who is a regular commentator on defense issues in China. But he said, quote, but it needs to be clarified that, first of all, Japan does not dare to confront China alone. If Japan involves itself in Taiwan, into the Taiwan question militarily, it will be Japan digging its own grave. Japan's military capability is completely restrained by the U.S. and does not have an independent combat capability. It's easy for the People's Liberation Army to paralyze the attack capability of the Japanese Self-Defense Force. Japan itself is powerless against China. And a day later, the Chinese Communist Party put a video out there. And this was done on mid-month. So, you know, we're coming up in about 10 days of the anniversary of the nuking of Hiroshima and Nagasaki at the end of World War II. But the Chinese Communist Party posted a video online Monday warning Japan that they would face retaliation by nuclear bombardment if they interfere in China's growing reunification efforts with China. This is a quote from the video. Quote, we will use nuclear bombs first. We will use nuclear bombs continuously. We will do this until Japan declares unconditional surrender for a second time, unquote. That's classic East Asian, I want to insult you, make you lose face, bombastic. And everybody knows the history of Japan and China. History is back and conflict is back. There's also been some great writing recently about China is very interested in getting into the more than a token ICBM presence to threaten the United States with the almost Soviet-like strategic nuclear forces. I don't know what holiday people expected they had, but it's even in the nuclear arena, we're back to Cold War-like concerns.
Yeah, speaking about that, I mean, I guess the Brits have decided to permanently deploy some warships to Asia, which is good, which is great, actually, and the Germans are sending a ship over there to play in the Pacific, too. You know, I think that the 1,000 ship navy, which included a lot of our allies in one of our previous maritime strategies. You know, there's a lot to be said for asking our allies for support, and especially good solid allies like the Brits and the Aussies and some of the others. So I think that's a really good sign, and that the Royal Navy has a role in the Pacific. The Commonwealth is important, and I'm glad they've decided to reinforce that.
Yeah, it's curious. They mentioned in a couple of the articles that I read about it that they're not going to have a permanent base, kind of like they had in Bahrain, which sounds to me that sounds like a deployment where you go from port to port to port. I wonder if they do that continuously, whether they will try to leverage off of what we do with our LCS in Singapore. I don't know what the maintenance facilities are like in Darwin, but it's kind of out of the way. I mean, they have, you know, some Commonwealth nations around there. Probably the most capable would be Singapore, but as everybody knows from 1941 and 42, if war breaks out in that part of the world, north of Indonesia and west of Guam is very dangerous waters to have your fleets in. So maybe they would want to have facilities elsewhere. But it's good to show the flag. And, you know, the Germans have gone out there. The French are going to be going out there. But the former Midrats guest, Sebastian Bruns, he had an article out early last week about the frigate Bayern, which is their version of Bavaria, which I guess is the correct version, but we'll call it Bavaria. The Bayern is going to be doing the Westpac deployment. And there's just a little throwaway line that with a lot of our European allies, and I would encourage people to look up Chinese trade with Europe, but it talks about the bad part of it is, quote, on the other hand, China's potential counter-reactions need to be closely monitored and dangerous escalation avoided, especially in light of China's current conventional and nuclear capability and Germany's economic dependence on the Middle Kingdom, unquote. Not interdependence, not trade relations. So we've reached the point here halfway through 2021 that nations such as Germany, in addition to what the Polish deputy foreign minister called Nord Stream 2, the Molotov-Ribbentrop pipeline, that Germany not only is tying herself economically to Russia, but Sebastian Bruns knows his stuff about Germany, where they will even admit the fact that they're economically dependent on America's greatest competitor right now. I don't know when the last time I heard any German say they're economically dependent on the United States. I don't think they are.
Well, kind of a different to the way we approach our relations with Germany. I mean, how many U.S. troops do we still have there? And so they may not be, quote, economically dependent on us necessarily. But every time we say, well, you know, it's time to bring our troops home from Germany, there sure is a bunch of hubbub raised by that. You're a NATO kind of guy, so you know more about it than I do.
Yeah. No, the bad thing about drinking with Germans is the volume. So you're about a liter and a half into drinking. You say things like, those that have socialized with me know that my tongue can get a little loose I think it's funny, but other people don't. I said, yeah, your economy does great. It'd be a shame if all of a sudden you had to double your defense budget because we left you to your own devices. That sets them back because, in a way, they say, well, you know, we have a military dependency on our alliance. There is an economic portion there because they have the luxury of avoiding making certain budget decisions because their security is underwritten by the American taxpayer. I believe they are spending between 1.2 and 1.4. If they had to spend just 2%, where are they going to find that money? They're already very, very, very highly taxed in Germany. They, for obvious reasons, they still remember the bad part of deficit spending, so they're not going to do that. it would impact their economy sufficiently. So, yeah, they are economically dependent because we underwrite their defense. And they use their view. Many of them don't see it that way. A lot of it has to do with pride, but a lot of it also has to do with just base mercantilistic greed, which is why they are putting themselves into a dependency status with Russia to heat their houses. It's sad to see Germany. I love Germany. I love Germans. It's a great country, great people. But their leaders, every few generations, tend to make decisions that have horrendous long-term economic consequences for the German people. And putting yourself under dependency on the Russians to heat your home and the Chinese to keep your paycheck coming in, that's going back to what we talked about at the beginning of the show. You know, are you short-term focused or are you long-term focused? Are you willing to make 98 cents today and be more secure in the long run, or would you rather make a dollar today to sacrifice your future security? Too many people are taking a dollar today and letting the risk be left to fate and other generations, as opposed to taking a little bit of a sacrifice now to have a more secure future. And I think that's a manifestation of that mindset as well.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, we see that in a lot of different places. I mean, that's, but to go back to what we talked about, to go back to what we talked about in the, as you say, in the beginning of the show, I mean, if your focus, let's just talk about the Navy, if the focus is on where are we going to be 5 years from now, and we always have these shipbuilding plans, which are going to go off in the future, we're going to have X number of cruisers and X number of attack submarines, whatever. If your focus is skewed when you start looking at that by visions of sugar plums, you know, somebody needs to be your reality check. And Navy Austin points out that if you're going to innovate, and you know, he worked in the private sector and as he says, startups, you innovate, you should have like one great idea. Everything else, if you have one innovation, think of all the things that have to change to make that innovation work. And that's what's we go back to the Ford Carrier, that's what's screwed up about that. You know, the concept, the grand concept, well, we'll do this, it'll be automatic, we won't have electronic, instead of those nasty steam-powered catapults, we're going to have electromagnetic things to throw the airplanes off the ship. You know, that sounds great. But, you know, then you do that in conjunction with these magical elevators and weapon ammo elevators, whatever they are, they're screwy. You know, it's the one bridge too far thing. You know, it's you've really got to be focused on if we're going to make improvements, great. And as you said, go back to those old days, got a cruiser, we're going to do this. It'll be the big innovation at the version one. We'll see how it works, and then when that didn't work or does work, then we can add change two to the second one. You know, that kind of iterative process is really important. And we made so many changes so dramatically. You know, we're going to close these shipyards. We're going to send all our auxiliaries to the military sea lift command. We're going to have all these. We're going to get rid of all these ships that are still useful, have useful lives. But it'll be great because, you know, 5 years from now we're going to have LCSs or whatever the vision of the future was. But again, you know, how many modules for the LCSs are now employed on LCSs?
that's a tricky question. I saw a Twitter exchange where somebody made a comment about mine warfare. It's like, well, with the LCS mission module for MIW, and they're like, what are you talking about? You can't do that with those things. But one thing that I did a few weeks ago that I'd encourage everybody to do, it's helpful to go back to see what people thought at a moment in time, is I look back at the Congressional Research Service's report from 2006 about, I think it was the 2005 shipbuilding plan, or from 2005 about 2006 shipbuilding. Anyway, mid-decade of zero-zeros. That was before the concerns about LCS and DDG 1000 had developed critical mass, and that's when people assumed that we were going to be competent in our program management. But it's amazing, look at what they considered the future. Not only did they think that there were going to be over 30 Zoom vaults, but they were talking about DDGX, which is going to be replaced for the Arleigh Burks, and they were talking about CGX, replacement for the Tycos, that all should be displacing water right now. And of course, we only got three little test platforms out of Zumwalt. There is no DDGX. There is no CGX. We just have Arleigh Burks being built till the crack of doom, and whatever this large service combatant will come up with. And it all goes back to CNO Gilday's comments last week about technology. That was that time where if it briefed well, it got the funding. And somewhere the disconnect came in when people were developing programs like, should we brief that? And there were people like Tal Manville who were trying to steer things in this direction, but they failed, and that's not their fault. Do we want to brief that? Are we sure you want to use the most optimistic assumption? You're talking as if this thing actually exists. Do you want to promise that? You know, those are the type of questions you're going to have to give her different answers to, because in 2022, when we read that Congressional Research Service report on our shipbuilding plan, you know, we should ask ourselves 15 years down the road in 2035, what are people going to think about the, you know, what are we getting right? What are we getting wrong? Hopefully not that much, because we've already lost a generation there. I think it's always important to look at that. You know, where are your big points of failure? The only thing that I'm not really concerned with, which I probably shouldn't jinx it, I at least think when I read what we're doing with the submarine program, we're probably going to be okay, because that's one thing that I don't say enough that I probably should. You have to give some credit to the submarine community. They've been fairly good on their programs the last quarter century.
Yeah, I go back to World War II. I mean, this is, but I'm looking at Admiral Wiley, right? The guy, he's got a really good book on strategy, but he also invented the CIC. He also, you know, he's the guy that when radar is out, but not every ship had it in those days. So somebody had to figure out, well, how are we going to use radar to do our job? And, you know, there were people who were using a new innovation, and somebody had to figure out, sit down and go, well, you know, it'd be really nice if we're going to fight at night to be able to know where the bad guys were. So, you know, and we got to do, in order to do that, we got to be able to plot and all this stuff to make sure we're not shooting our own guys and staying out of, you know, shoal water and all that. Well, you know, a single innovation, wisely applied, and how much difference did that make in the war at sea? Well, huge difference. When they put it on airplanes, and on aircraft carriers, you knew where the enemy planes were coming from. I mean, that kind of innovation did make a huge difference. But somebody had to give. I mean, I think if the story that I remember correctly was he was given a week or two to go figure out how to set up a combat information center to and then take it out to the fleet and apply it. But you know, again, even if he'd screwed it up, even if he'd gotten it all wrong the first time, somebody else would have said, you know, that was screwed up, but But, you know, if we'd done this, it might have worked. I mean, that's the kind of thought process we need for this stuff. And that single innovation applied soon enough and giving everybody the right tools to do the job and the right training, you know, we wouldn't be having this discussion right now if the Navy had not, the surface Navy especially, had not kind of fallen down on that part of what the leadership should be doing and worrying less about the kind of management that, you know, is also important, but not as important as being able to lead and have a, and leading involves having some kind of vision as to where you're going to take everybody. And I look at the fleet and I go, God, what message are our sailors getting about what's important right now? You know, is it, boy, we got to be super ready to go fight somebody, or is it, gee, if you say the wrong thing to somebody, you could be found to be a bad person and dismissed from the service. I mean, that just drives me nuts.
Yeah, and unfortunately, the latter part of what you said, that's what everybody is hearing because that's what they're hearing our senior leadership talk about, as opposed to rising above it and focusing on their mission. They want to do somebody else's mission. Hey, I just realized we're past the hour, but I wanted before we ended is we have the greatest cadre of prior guests of any national security podcast in existence. Dr. Phil Ware, he sent me a little note. He's our token man with the very civilized British accent. When we were talking about the Royal Navy, their plan to support their ships because they're not going to have a permanent maintenance facility, and they're going to be using those, you know, what we've talked about here, those offshore patrol vessels, I guess, for a lot of their presence operations, which is perfect for them. But they're going to, and this is something where I'm not going to say that I'm a little envious, but I'm a little envious. So you're going to have these crews of an OPV, which, you know, if you've served with a small crew, you know how great that is. But they're going to expect to do their maintenance at BAE's Australia facility in Osborne, which is in Adelaide, Australia. You can throw me in that briar patch any day. And they're also going to be doing some work in Singapore. They're going to come up to Yokosuka, which does great maintenance. And so they're going to have a similar situation like the Brits do with their Caribbean station ship that comes up to Mayport or goes over to Durban in South Africa to get some work done. But I tell you what, the Royal Navy, where they're trying to get manning for these OPVs, like, yeah, you're going to be spending, young man, young lady, you're going to be spending lots of time in Japan, Australia, and Singapore. They should have no problem manning those ships. That's great duty.
Yeah, that would be a terrible environment to work in. But you're right. We need to say goodbye to everybody. let them go do the useful things in their lives instead of listening to us rant and rave.
Yes, sir. Well, as always, Eagle One and everybody in the chat room, we had some great interchange and ideas coming through the chat room. And also, Phil, thank you for the quick note to make sure that everybody has the right page of the hymnal about what the Royal Navy plans to do, and it's great to have them east of Suez again. And I hope everybody has a great week, and keep track of us for our announcements for our next show of Midrats. And until then, we hope y'all have a great Navy day. Cheers.
Or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Farewell, let us dwell.
Hello!